Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Alexandra Metters from GalacticConnection.com, and this is the radio show program for tomorrow, which would be July 7th, I believe, 2015. We are actually on site at the East Seti Ranch, up with James Gilliland this last couple of, 4 days or so, and just having a blast. Learned a lot, experienced a lot. Life-changing events for many of us here, and I thought this was an appropriate time to go ahead and take advantage of interviewing some of the people here. Today we're going to be interviewing Randy Kramer. Many of you know him. He's near and dear to many of your hearts and souls out there who are totally into the galactic thing. But before we dive into that, I just wanted to remind everybody, please check out Galactic Connection's daily blog. It runs 365 days a year. You'll get a smattering of everything from spirituality all the way to quantum physics, and try to stay abreast of what's going on a daily basis. We also have the world-renowned implant removal series, along with My Alchemy and a lot of other cool stuff. So just stay tuned, because there's a lot happening, and we will be used as a main conduit for the announcements. So I'm not going to waste much more time. Randy, and it's interesting because there's actually several of you that wrote in to me and asked me to interview Randy, and behold, he and I both showed up at this event as speakers. So, that ended up reuniting a very ancient relationship, I think, that we both realized.
Sure seems that way.
Yeah, it sure seems that way. So, if you're not familiar with Randy, you can go ahead and check his website out. It's earthcitizenconsulting.org. He is revamping his site. It should be up and running in about a week or two.
Oh, no, I'd say before the end of the week.
Before the end of the week. Yeah. And so just bear with him. He's constantly reminding people that it's kind of in flux right now. And for those of you that are not familiar with his background, he is a captain in the U.S. Marine Corps. He's had over 20-plus years of active service. And I must say, he's an enlisted officer, which is a hell of an accomplishment. And this is just kind of near and dear to my heart since I'm a military brat, as many of you know. And so what we're going to do is we're just going to kind of wing it today, because even I have had very little time to check out his background. All I know is the person behind all the stories now that I've hung out with him for the last 4 days. And I think the first thing right out the gate, and a couple of people had asked me this, is can you just explain how you functioned with your parents to get into this role? I mean, how would your parents dive from, oh, hey, Mom, I'm going into the military, to I'm patrolling Mars?
Well, the first part of that is, I mean, essentially during my entire tour, they were unaware the covert ability for these programs to use time travel so that, you know, they essentially put you back right after they took you away. So what we call quantum dilation, which is if, you know, I departed on 2:30 a.m. November 18th, 1987, just the time and date, and then I came back 15 minutes later, but that was after a 20-year tour. Call that a quantum dilation. So basically, I come back, put back into a 17-year-old body. No one really knows the wiser, but then you're still left with all this psychological, emotional torment and these images of everything just at first not the linear connector to, like, make it all really make sense, because you have all this memory, you have all this emotion, you have all this trauma, and you even have these very real vivid images of these experiences. But when you check that against your linear experience, you're just like, well, that's not in any kind of rational order. And it's that quantum dilation that kind of takes things out of that rational order, that until you understand that that's what happened, you can go, oh, and then, like, really put things in the right linear direction. There's just a lot of confusion and self-doubt, and that comes from, like, did I dream that? Am I tripping? I mean, there's just this kind of, did someone dose my tea this morning? I mean, you really have to ask all these questions, because you have to consider every single other possibility. You know, I mean, okay, so it was Conan Doyle and the Shakespeare, I mean, sorry, Sherlock Holmes quote, that, you know, when you have eliminated all possibilities, no matter what remains, no matter how probable, that's it, because that's all you have left. So in this sense, it really is that process of elimination. Well, it can't be this, it can't be, you know, what if it's this, what if it's that, what if that, and going on all those things, no matter how weird or irrational some of them may be, but you have to eliminate them all until you go, well, Those have all been eliminated. The only thing I've got left is this really weird thing that shouldn't make any rational sense, but if it's the only thing left, you know, that's kind of like you have to start from there. And so at that point, it becomes still a lot more, well, is this really true? I mean, you're really just searching of, is this really true? Is this really true? I'm a skeptical person, even of my own experiences. So if I feel like that's my experience, I'm actually going to ask myself that question about 100 times before I'm going to be like, okay. Yes.
Good point. Well, how did your... I mean, you must have been an absolute handful for your parents. Especially if there was a lot of emotional anguish in what you were doing versus where you were trying.
Really, you know, I was fairly self-contained about it and kept to myself about it. I think from a very young age, I had a pretty good social intelligence. So like facial expressions, body language, that look of parental concern, you know, so you say the wrong thing, you know, and all of a sudden people are like, you know, is he okay? Do we need to take him to the doctor? And, you know, so when you kind of have that feedback, you feel like, oh, I guess I shouldn't have said that. You know, I don't want to worry anybody. I don't want that look of consternation and concern. And so I just kind of learned to keep to myself about it and not tell anybody about it.
Did you have suspicions before you were 17?
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially because of physical marks, you know, like bruises in the thighs, you know, needle marks and really, I mean, weird things that if you really looked at them rationally, you'd go, oh, my God, that's so obvious. But because you, what? No, that, no, I wasn't going to abduct it or anything like that. You look for any other answer other than the thing that it is, because to be honest, you don't want that to be true. Who wants that to be true?
Who wants that to be true?
You know, like abuse victims. Who wants that crap to be true? Absolutely. I mean, I certainly didn't want it to be true. So it was really just a matter of like, keep asking the question, calmly going through this, like the central nervous system memory, cellular memory, and really ask all the parts of the body, you know, is that the way you remember it? Is that the way you remember it? Is that how you remember it? And eventually, you know, I would say just when you've asked that question 100 times and you haven't gotten anything but the same answer every time, well, you know, that's a pretty good indication that you're hitting the jackpot there.
That's great advice for a lot of the abductees.
Yeah,
for sure.
A lot of people who contact me who have these issues, I essentially lay out the map for them that worked for me. You know, all I can say is, look, I don't know if this is going to work for you. I don't know if this is going to help you. This is what I had to do. Mm-hmm. So try this. Try that. And the people who I've been sorting stuff out with have been finding that in some cases, it's just that simple. You know, I've had many of these subjects, you know, come to me and ask me questions, and I can just say, well, that's kind of textbook, so here's, you know, your ABCD to deal with that. And most of them just go, oh, wow, that's so obvious. I wouldn't have thought of that. And I'm like, no, you wouldn't have thought of that. And you know what? I wouldn't have thought of it either until I had to work through it.
Yeah, exactly.
And the only reason I'm thinking of it is because I had to work through that crap. So, you know, I'm suggesting maybe you should look at that.
So you've mentioned many times about your specific genetic makeup mm-hmm. and how that's determined mm-hmm. your destiny. Mm-hmm. Can you go a little bit more into that?
You know, I don't think it's important to talk about specifics. All I can say is that, you know, there's no hodgepodge of genetics here, because whatever basic building blocks they took, they still engineered from the ground up. They still went through, you know, sequence by sequence and said, what do we want this to look like? What do we want this to look like? So in a really meticulous way, my entire genetic code was very specifically engineered for very specific short, long-term purposes. As well as I've said to people, a very unusual aspect of my development and my programming, which is to have a genetic and software programming so that at the end of all this process, where usually they just kind of discard people, that I was engineered and programmed to self-repair and reprogram myself.
That's wild.
I know.
That's just wild. Now, you did talk about how you've had your legs, your arms ripped off, and you've literally watched...
Oh, yeah, watch them grow it back in the holographic regenerating med beds.
And tell them how long did you see that happen for? Just to regrow an arm.
So let's just say, you know, you've got an above the elbow, you know, removal of a limb. And essentially they project this hologram that has cellular level resolution. So it's, you know, down to whatever HD that resolution is down to the cellular level. so that, you know, normally your cells would hit the oxygen here and go, oh, we can't go any further than that. But with that holographic arm, your body is tricked into thinking that there's still arm there. So it goes, hey, let's just keep connecting to these cells and these cells and these cells, and it just keeps going until it gets all the way down to the end and it regrows. Now, if, let's say the arm was still there, but it had been damaged. It was like burn, bam, blast, 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 but the structure of the arm is still there. It's not gone, but it's just complete hamburger.
Okay.
Now, that, they project that holographic pattern over that, and instead of the arm regrowing, it now is dominant harmonic frequency resonance, so that perfect genetic model of a perfect arm, this cellular tissue just wants to conform to that shape. It just wants to harmonize to that, you know, holographic geometric shape, and then essentially that damaged arm will just restore itself. So basically, to restore a damaged arm, wow, could take about an hour.
Take about an hour.
This could be a hamburger burnt to a crisp, crushed under a weight, you know, but if the arm's still there, about an hour. Maybe two if it's really, really bad. But a full regrow, depending on the breaks, you know, 5 to 6 hours, maybe seven.
That's amazing. So yeah.
So basically, you could get your arm blown off one day, end up in medical for the evening, and next day you're like, get your clearance, you're good to go, and you're back out in the field the next day.
It's kind of like the football players where they just bring them in and they've just been beaten up big time.
Oh,
and they
yeah.
just shoot them up with all these drugs and put them right back out in the field.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, it's a little bit better, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely what they did. It was just like, fix them, get them back out.
That's,
I mean,
crazy.
So, I mean, they really want to, they've spent so much money on us as individuals.
Yeah.
They want to get their money's worth. They
you're
want
like,
to make sure
you're
they're
like
getting
the
every
real
dollar.
Incredible jets, you know. The
well,
okay. billion-dollar jets.
Well, know? I asked the brigadier one time, like, what do you think the actual cost, you know, like am I this $8 million man? And he's like, well, probably $100 million.
Wow.
I'm like, whoa. And he's like, look, when you think about the program, the time, the personnel, he says, you know, in a the program that I was designed under was a program that had 300 subjects in it, young boys and girls, about a ratio three to one males to females, about a 75% were males and about 25% were females.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah. And so, you know, basically averaging the breaks of that 300, you know, per person, he says it's, you know, a little over $100 million each.
Wow.
And basically, no, when he told me that, I basically went, all right, whatever. I mean, so it doesn't matter to me what the cost is at that point. I don't care if it's millions, hundreds of millions.
But they have a lot invested in each
one. It's a lot. It's clearly that they have a lot invested, and that's why there's a 20-year tour, and that's why they fix everything, because they're going to keep using you. If you just, you know, walked out there and got blown up in a week and that was it, oh, man, what a waste of money, time, and resources that would be.
So how long was your actual training in preparation for this?
About a chronological period of what we would call, like, if you really just added up the minutes, hours, weeks, months of the training period, that's really like 12 years. Now, that's not
wow.
training over a 12-year period. That's like a 14-year period with a quantum dilation of 12 extra years of training, if that makes sense.
Wow. That does make sense. That's the way the military
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
So it's basically every possible scenario. Every possible...
We're clearly some of the most thoroughly trained individuals in the world, because they don't want to skip yeah. a beat. They don't want to miss anything. They want you to be prepared for anything. They really want you to be problem solvers. They don't want just, you know, order followers
yeah.
that can't think, because...
Resourceful.
Well, yeah, what's the point of having something you always have to tell what to do?
Correct.
You need something that can think on its own. Excuse me. And, is going to problem solve and go, how do I fix this? How do I get out of that? How do I get victory here? Instead of just, what do I do now? What do I do now? I mean, they don't want robots, but people sometimes think that they're just trying to make robots. They are not, other than actual mechanical robots, but out of people, they're not trying to make robots. They want fully functional, fully capable, problem solving, self-determined soldiers that can act on their own. That basically, you know, crazy stuff happens and you're all by yourself. You're not going to panic and freak out. You're still going to figure out something.
Situation.
You're either going to get out, finish your mission, you know, do or die. But you're not just going to go, oh, I'm all alone and freak out. You're going to get it done.
So do you feel that it's accurate to call you a super soldier? If not, where does the misnomer come? You know, there's this kind of definition assumption of what a super soldier is.
So sure.
Are you in that same category, truly? And how is that different from the MK Ultra?
Sure. I mean, that's where I would say that the difference in terminology between sort of external civilian terminology and internal military terminology. For example, some people still externally in the civilian world still like to say UFO, unidentified flying object. We don't ever say that in the military lexicon. We don't ever say UFO. It's not even a term that we use. It's either unidentified aerial phenomenon, but mostly we identify pretty quickly whether it belongs to us, mm-hmm. was made down here, mm-hmm. or it belongs to somebody that made it up there. Now, once that distinction of where it came from is divided, then it's labeled as one of two possible things, which is a extraterrestrial vehicle, or an ETV, or an alien reproduction vehicle, or an ARV. So basically, there is no unidentified flying objects. We either identify them as ARVs or ETVs, first of all.
Sure.
And so, or if it really is unidentified, then we'll call it an unidentified aerial phenomenon, call it a UAP. But nobody uses the term UFO. And I guess it should be important to know this. I mean, maybe some people don't know this. That in the early 40s and 50s, the public, the newspapers, no one used that term either. It was all flying saucers, flying discs, flying saucers.
That's right.
And it was the Air Force that basically said, came out and said, no, we're going to call them unidentified flying objects. We don't want flying saucers from space. We don't want people to panic. We're going to call it an unidentified flying object, which is one of the most slick linguistical judo tricks that anybody could have thought of, because they're not unidentified, they're identified.
Yes, that's
and
definitely
the tricky one, which is really a definition of aeronautical physics versus gravitic physics, they do not fly. Flying, they hover, they levitate, they do all of these other things, but they do not fly. Flying is an aspect of aeronautical physics that an airplane, a helicopter, something that is using aeronautical lift uses. That's something that flies. Something that hovers does not fly. So the reason they created that term is so people involved in research projects and reverse engineering projects, if they had to come in front of a congressional hearing and get asked, do you or anyone you know have participated in projects involving unidentified flying objects? And then the person being asked could, in absolute truth, not lying at all, say, no, I have never heard of any such thing whatsoever, because there are no unidentified flying objects. They don't fly, and they're identified. So it's a complete made-up turn to throw people off the track and allow someone to basically tell the truth in the face of questioning, but that truth is still a lie and a deception because they're not unidentified and they don't fly.
So back to the super soldier question.
Okay, so essentially we don't say super soldier, that's a civilian term. Okay. We say genetically augmented military trained or genetically augmented soldier, or to simplify, augmented soldier, or to even further simplify, an augment.
Okay.
So in military terms, I am either an augmented soldier or just an augment.
So how do you distinguish the difference between those that we hear about that are literally programmed where they're activated to go, you know, assassinate like right. a president or so something, versus apparently the types of missions you've done, which were literally really trying to clean up the solar system and assist the planet?
Right. Well, the first distinction you kind of make is the difference between a military trained subject, a military trained augment, versus an intelligence community created augment. Those are two very, very different things, because if it's made by any of the programs in the intelligence community, it's not going to be governed by any of the legal protocols that the military is obligated to abide by. So a military augment is going to have certain requirements, legal requirements on how and what you can do with it. And I'm not saying that's always pleasant. You can still do some pretty nasty thing with military augments.
Yeah.
But basically an intelligence augment is just going to be kind of anything, everything that you could want it to do. And that's not a nice, I mean, it could be really terrible, horrible kind of things that you could want to do with that person. So I guess that's how I would distinguish those two.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
So I'm going to apologize right now in case I lose my train of thought or I start talking like a silly person.
Because you're running on minimal sleep.
I had 3 hours of sleep last night, and I'm running on maximum coffee. Well, let me just say this. This has been an event that has exceeded all of my expectations.
Oh, yeah, mine too.
I knew that when I came out here that this was going to be a great time, a great trip, that I was going to meet fabulous people and make great connections and give a great talk. And I just knew it was going to be great, but it has exceeded every single expectation that I could have possibly had.
I second that.
And as I said, you know, you heard me kind of screaming yesterday, I'm the happiest. I mean, there's some things occurred that made me a very, very happy Marine. And so I feel so good about my work right now. I feel so good about the work that we're doing. Right. And obstacles that have been removed,
yes,
and people, yes, who have able to provide serious logistical information and support, and, yes, just the amazing amount of information that I've been able to sort of report on and
this was truly
turn into case files.
This was divinely ordered, almost. You know,
if one chooses to see the universe as divinely ordered, then you could certainly say that. I would say that, as I gave in my lecture on the laws of psionics, that is an aspect of physics of harmonic psionic resonance,
which
people want to call that divine intervention, they can be the same thing. Two different words to describe similar things.
So, I was remiss in going into detail as to your full-blown background in the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the first questions right out the gate is, how does someone who's listening to you and hear this type of information, how do they check you out to know that you're legitimate?
Well, I mean, again, because as I was discussing the laws of psionics, we've had that conversation, that the best way for a person who has a amount of psionic and personal development to get their truth sense, but certainly a person who doesn't have that much development, their truth sense may not really give them an accurate read. So people, if they're developed, they can try and use their truth sense and feel if that, you know, is resonating information to them. And, you know, people who want to think otherwise is fine, but really, factually, it's kind of this simple, and I've had to deal with plenty of people giving me crap, but I have had an amazing supportive structure of people who I've talked to who have not given me any crap or hard time. In fact, the only people who give me a hard time are people on the internet, you know, kind of what people I call wannabes. I know lots of information, and it's like, oh, I'm so glad you do. And where are you publicly speaking this week, and where's your book, and how many people care about what you say?
Right.
And most of the time, these are people who don't have any public support for what they do or any, like, amount of, you know, vetting of what they do. They're just a person with an opinion. Every single time I've had a chance to talk to a person in an official position, and without naming names, because I don't think these people would like their names mentioned, I have spoken to numerous administrative-level people in locals where I live and where I come from. I have spoken to a couple different local Marine Corps commanders locally in reserve stations close to where I live. I have had a chance to speak to my congressman's office and his aides to file paperwork to get my records. So, you know, people want to see my records.
Mm-hmm.
When I get those, I'll be happy, you know, mm-hmm, to show them. But I've been told by a JAG officer and my congressman's office and their aide that this is not something that happens quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be a 10-year process. Essentially, okay, here are some facts. If you are a soldier, any branch of the military, you're a normal person, no classifications, you had a silly, unclassified job, like you're a medic or something, and you're having any issues with your paperwork or your benefits, the average wait time to sort that out is over 460 days. Now, that's if you got no complications. No complications. You add complications like high-level security clearance, special access program, unacknowledged special access program. Well, you just might as well add years for every one of those factors on how long it's going to take you to get through the bureaucracy, because these guys are having a hard enough time. And they're getting processed first.
That's
we're on the back burner because they don't want to deal with us first.
Right.
So essentially, we're going to get
like
got. Yeah, we're going to get got to when they are damn well ready to get around to us. And so, when I talked to this JAG officer at the space conference in Colorado Springs a number of years ago, which was a pretty fascinating experience, all that brass and all that space tech and all those industry people, and you could really, you know, kind of hear the whispers of, you know, how about the TR-3B, John? And I mean, you know, like, And then, you know, and so basically I was, working for a friend who was doing, sort of a setup of one of the events. The keynote speaker was this astronaut who was speaking, and I didn't get a chance to hear him. I was really wanting to set it, but we were doing this sort of setup. And, it was kind of this weird, it was maybe a kind of a weird fated situation because I ended up in Colorado Springs, oddly at that time. I ended up working for my friend, oddly at that time. And then all of a sudden she's like, oh, hey, we got to do the space conference this week. And I was like, space conference? And so
let's be there.
I was like, ooh, that sounds like fun. And they had like a huge display of the Webb telescope. I mean, this was a number of years ago. Like the Webb wasn't, you know, coming out for another 10, 15 years, but they had this major display. Like, this is the new big thing in X-ray cosmic telescopes. And they had this huge display of it, and they had this, you know, CGI movie that was playing through how they're going to send it up and deploy it, and it opens up. It was all very cool. So they were really pushing that.
It's kind of cool that you were there for that.
I was.
Well, it's like historical.
It was kind of. And for the number of people who were there, you know, it was kind of like, does nobody know that this is going on? You know, this is a 5-star hotel, and there's thousands of people here. They've got booths and all their stuff. I mean, does everybody know what's going on?
That's wild.
And so essentially, as I was walking around in the building, looking, you know, I was really watching for the patches and badges and pins and so forth, and I saw a guy. I was like, oh, he's a JAG officer. And so a Marine Corps JAG officer essentially said, excuse me, if you know, to have a minute, you know, I just can ask you a quick question. And he was, sure. And I said, you know, I have a friend, you know, right? I have a friend, you know, me being right, that who's trying to get his records. And I said, look, you know, he's not trying to be a whistleblower. He's not trying to, you know, make waves, but he was in an unacknowledged special access program and just wants benefits, you know, like, come on. He did the work. He wants his bennies. And is there anything we can do? And he said, yeah, absolutely. He said, but here's what you need to check with your friend about. He says, you know, you need to make sure that your friend is willing to do this for no less than 10 years, is when they commit that much time.
Wow.
And he said, because
can you get over that?
It could easily just not get done in any less amount of time. So he said, as long as your friend is willing to wait as long as or more, you know, 10 years or more to sort through this process, then...
That's insane.
Then go for it. Go through it. But if you're not willing to wait that long, you're going to waste time getting into it and abandoning. Just, you got to be willing to give that much time because it could take that much time. And he explained, it's because of that layering. You know? It's like, if you were in an SAP, you know, 5 years minimum. You're in a USAP, 10 years minimum. Yeah. You know, so it
That's
just could,
crazy.
Yeah, it could just take a really long time. So, and, but here's the other thing he said that really clarified something for me. It was one of those things that, it was completely logical, and when he said it, it made complete sense. But like so many other things that are completely logical and make sense, if you hadn't thought of it before that minute, you just didn't think of it. And so when he mentioned this, I was like, oh, aha. And what he said was, he said, look, with an unacknowledged special access program, you have a security clearance that grants you access to that program and access to information to that program. So he said, let's say it's Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. You're being exited from the program. You've signed off all your papers. You've turned in all of your special equipment, special uniform, anything that's particular to that security clearance. You've signed off. There's the door. You go out the door. Bye, everybody. And you shut the door. He said, if, you know, 1 second after you shut that door and you say, oh, I forgot something. And you turn around and you say, hey, I need to know such and such. And they go, what are you talking about? We know what you're talking about. I mean, at that point, you are now on the outside of that unacknowledged special access program. And what you knew about and had accessed 5 minutes ago, now you don't. And they're going to deny and not tell you anything. So basically, he said, you're not going to be able to request paperwork because it's unacknowledged to you. And there's no way that they'll give you that information because you walk in and say, hey, I was in this program. I want to get my records. And they'll go, we don't know anything about that. There's no such program. They'll just, you know, show you the door. He said, so, and this is, but then he said, again, a smart thing that was like, oh, that makes sense. He said, what you have to do is you have to go through an elected representative, basically a congressman or senator's office, and they can fill out the paperwork. They can request the records. They can go through that process because there's an intermediary sort of security access area where then you might be able to get to those records through someone who actually does have the permission to look for them and ask for them once you've signed the proper release forms and so forth. So I had to go in and, you know, fill out a standard Form 180, which is to get records, had to sign a Privacy Act release and all this paperwork so they could do that process for me. And basically, I knew where the records were. My Brigadier General told me where the records were. They're in this NSA archive somewhere.
Uh-oh. And
so, yeah, right?
And so basically what you're saying is anybody who wants to check you out is going to take up to possibly plus 5 years on.
Maybe.
If they really wanted to look at your records, per se.
Maybe. Well, and okay, so this is the funny thing about, I say, hey, I know the records are with the NSA archive. And then the aide who I was working with, this really fabulous guy, the congressman's military aide who deals with all the veteran cases, really nice guy. And I'm telling you, you know, I'm coming in this with this crazy story. At no point did anybody look at me like, you know, maybe he should take his medication. I mean, never, never. I mean, I went into my congressman's office. I wrote this down. I signed my statement. I said, this is my sworn statement. I just want my records, man. I just want my bennies and my records. That's all I want. I'm not trying to be anything other than a guy who wants what the contract he signs that he's supposed to get. I fulfilled my end of that contract. How about we make sure that they fulfill their end of that contract? This is a legal contract in which both parties are obligated to fulfill their obligation. I fulfilled my obligation to that contract. They need to fulfill their obligation to that contract. So in that process, at no point did I get the brush off, did I get, you know, this or that. They were the nicest, most straightforward. And I really was getting the impression were really curious and wanted to know more and were kind of jazzed to see if they could get access to this information. But I also got the impression that they knew this process enough to know, like, yeah, this is not going to be fast. This is not going to be easy. This is not going to be fun. But what was funny is I said, okay, they're at the NSA archives. I know it. So let's go look for it there. And he was like, well, we can't do that. What do you mean? He said, well, there's a process. He said, if we don't go to the National Archives 1, and then if we don't go to the National Archives 2, and then if we don't go to the Manpower Management Support Branch, and all these other potential record-keeping agencies that could have it, he said, and he's the one who told me this, he said, look, if we don't go ask all these other people first, if we go ask the NSA and say, hey, we want to see these records, they're going to say, well, did you ask National Archives 1? Did you ask? So basically, if you skip the order, they're going to tell you to go back to square one and go through the order anyway. So it doesn't matter that they've got it. They want you to ask everybody else who doesn't have it in order for you to have all the paperwork that says they don't have it, they don't have it, they don't have it, they don't have it, they don't have it. So you guys got to look for it. Then basically they go, well, okay, I guess we do have to look for it now. So there's that process. But here's the other thing that I started to feel was it was a problem, was I kept saying, look, come on, I know we got to go through this, but who's next? When do we get to the NSA? And this is, you know, certainly at a period of time a few years ago when I started this, and I think we're still kind of in this period where people are terrified of the NSA. And I don't just mean civilians and citizens. I mean government personnel, you know, elected officials, because the NSA has such this power to get up your butt with a flashlight. Like, who wants to knock on their door and get their attention? Like, what are you knocking on my door? What's going on with you? You don't want that NSA flashlight up your butt because they might find something and they might go, oh, we found this. Why are you? I mean, it's essentially this very threatening, bullying, you know, well, we know this now, and what about that? And we've got some evidence and pictures of you. And, you know, really just as soon as you start saying, hey, you know, I got a constituent who needs his records, if they don't want to really follow the law, well, they're going to go with a bullying tactic of some kind. So I was really just getting the impression that the main problem was no one wanted to go knock on the NSA's door. So as much as they were like, yeah, let's go through this process, when it came to going to the NSA, it was like, I don't want to go to the... I mean, no one wants to do it. No one wants to go and knock on their door and make them be accountable to the stuff.
Did you?
Well, we're still in that process. And essentially, here's where I've been left in that process, is that I'm now at a point where my congressman's office and the aide have kind of made it pretty clear that they said, look, we've kind of at a stuck spot, and again, I won't mention the guy's name because he certainly doesn't want the attention. Yeah, but he was so cool, and he said, look, he said, we're at this place where in order for us to proceed, he said, and again, I want to emphasize this, we are not saying we disbelieve you. We are not saying that we don't think that you are a sincere individual who has every right to file this paperwork and look for this record. I mean, there was a tacit, you know, acceptance without admitting, you know, we believe you. No one really said, we believe you, but it was like, we don't think you're lying. Mm-hmm. We don't think you're deceiving us. We don't think you're doing this to get any kind of weird attention. We believe that you are sincerely trying to get your records, and we would very much like to help you with that. But we are at a point where you're going to have to start submitting legal letters from a lawyer.
God.
In order to push this down the road, in order to kick this can down the road, you're going to need some lawyer power, you know. And I was like, oh, okay. And so part of the problem, and there is a complication of both, you know, attorneys who don't want to touch this, you know, like
right.
they don't want to like
get they don't up. Want to rub elbows in this kind
well,
of
well, yeah, they don't want to make the NSA mad
community.
Either. But the other problem is, like, do you have any idea how many qualified attorneys in this area of searching for record keeping that there are? I can tell you without naming their names, there are three. There are three in the entire continental United States who have any serious expertise at filing this paperwork and getting results. Now, I've talked to, some other attorneys who have some ideas, a FISA court lawsuit, you know, because there's no way we're going to go through regular court, but basically a FISA, a Federal Intelligence Security court, which is covert, secret. We go in there and it's a secret closed door meeting. And, you know, we basically are saying we need to sue for these records. We need to sue on behalf of our clients now.
Oh, my God.
But basically that hasn't been done yet. No one's done that. So the notion of doing that is a good notion, but no one's done it yet. So until we can succeed at that, we don't know how that's going to work. So with the three people, And to be honest, they're getting to be these older lawyers who are kind of like, can't take new cases. Mm-hmm. To be honest, they're getting tired. I mean, Daniel Sheehan is just getting to this point in his career where he's doing other things. And to be honest, I think he's burnt on, you know, disclosure stuff. And I think he spent the last 20 years working on it. And now it's just like, oh, how can I do this? And I think he's really changed his focus to more like on the ground sort of social justice stuff again, because like this exopolitics stuff is just, you know, it's a lot of brick walls. So with those three people, only those three like qualified, experienced attorneys who have real experience doing this again and again for years, you know, trying to get any one of them to take the case is just not happening. And trying to get some other younger, excited attorney to take the case is, you know, they don't want to touch it. So, you know, I kind of said, well, geez, what am I going to have to do? Go be my own lawyer and go to law school myself? Maybe. So there was a period of time, like about a year and a half ago, I was just so burning. I was like, fine, I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to go to law school. I'll be my own lawyer and I'll file my own paperwork. And other stuff has happened that I haven't, like, signed up and enrolled in law school to do that. But
too busy.
But clearly, you know, without going to law school, I know it's also possible to go to the law library, start breaking out books, and talk to some other advisors to say, here, look at this, look at that. I get that. So, you know, maybe when I've got, you know,
that's insane,
50 hours a week to go to the law library and start digging through legalese, then maybe, you know, I can do that. So basically, here's the answer to that question.
Okay.
I don't know when we're going to get there, but I'm
dedicated. I think we all figure that out.
But I'm dedicated to the process. I am in no way like backing off or saying whatever. It's like, if this is slow and steady wins the race, like the tortoise, we're just going to do it. And so I tell you what, when I get records, I will publish stuff on my site and people will be the first to know, and I'll do interviews about it. But we're waiting for that. So here's my other answer to that. Okay. The simple answer is that what I am doing when I say, and I have said many times, both in writing and verbally, this is my sworn testimony as a United States military officer. Mm-hmm. Now, some people don't understand the legal liability of that. Okay? So let me explain a little thing about legal liability. If you are a doctor or a lawyer or a United States military officer, there are certain freedoms you do not have. If you commit fraud of any kind, you lie publicly in any way, you make gain off of a criminal act or of a fraudulent act in any way. If you are a lawyer, you can be disbarred. If you are a doctor, you can lose your medical license. And if you are a military officer, that is a felony. That is several felonies. You can be tried and charged under the UCMJ. If you're impersonating an officer, that is a felony. Okay? So if I'm a liar, in any way, shape, or form, if I say this is my sworn testimony and that's a lie, I'm a felon. And the truth is, and I've talked to an attorney about this, if I'm committing those crimes, there's a process for that, and I'm very public. So it would mean that either one or both of the Marine Corps or the FBI would send me a letter and say, you need to show proof or cease and desist. Which, I'd love it if they did that. Because basically, then I would have the paper.
I was going to say, you'd get the paperwork,
then,
right?
Well, then I would have that paperwork, and then I could say, great, you guys want to like me to show proof? Then let's have a hearing. Let's set up the hearing. Let me get my JAG representation. Let me get my paperwork to file. Let's go ahead and do it. And then that opens a door that then they have to allow me a JAG representative.
Sure.
They have to let me
file. It'll
speed
up the process.
Well, and it will essentially allow something to happen that they don't want to happen. Mm-hmm. They don't want to accelerate that process. So if I were truly breaking the law, if I were truly committing a fraudulent, felonious act, I would have received letters by now. I would have received a, hey, you need to... I would have also received, I think, way more negative feedback from real military officers and real Marines. And you know what? I have not had a single military officer, a single Marine, look at me and go, you're full of crap.
And
in fact, it has been the opposite. Been the opposite. Every single Marine I have ever met has given me a Semper Fi, slapped me on the back, and said, thank you so much. And I'm telling you, if other Marines can smell Marine on me,
well, trust me, you can smell Marine on me.
Okay, you know, I mean, that should be good
he
enough
reeks,
for... That should
Marine.
Be good enough... Thank you.
No, I'm serious.
Yeah, I mean,
that
should be good enough for people who understand the law and legal liability. I cannot be legally doing this if I'm committing fraud.
Yeah.
So I realize for some people, if they don't understand the legalese, that may not resonate in their brain to understand that. But anyone who understands legal liability understands that I cannot be lying or committing fraud without cuffs being on me and all kinds of crap happening.
Well, and I wanted that out of the way.
No, thank you. I appreciate that.
So
I'd like to clarify that.
That it's important for the entire, spiritual, ufology, conspiracy community to get the legitimacy of what you're doing. So
let me say this, just real quick. If I was making up this story, it would make so much more sense to me just say, well, I'm a sergeant, because that doesn't carry the same legal liability of saying I'm an officer. Mm-hmm. I would say, I'm a sergeant, because then that could slip under the wire. But the instant that I say, no, I'm standing firm in what my highest rank, what my security clearance, where what I earned, I earned my bars. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't get that given to me in a Cracker Jack box. I earned that. I clawed my way up from the bottom. I am a Mustang officer. I started at the bottom, clawed my way up to sergeant major, and got my promotion, got my officer candidate school, and I earned those bars. So anyone who thinks otherwise, you know, bring it. Okay?
Trust me, he's serious. Okay, well,
yeah,
let's shift gears.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit more about your cruising through the solar system.
Yes.
Because that's what everybody really wants to hear
about.
Yeah,
it's fun.
And you've talked about 17-plus years where you were literally in a war situation on planet Mars.
Right, right. Would 17
you,
years, 3 months, 14
that's
days,
right.
22-hour duties counting.
Yeah, exactly. He knows it to the minute, basically. So, during that very long period of time, are you at liberty to share what was the ultimate agenda and what was the ultimate victory?
I cannot in any way, because I just don't know, what the ultimate goal was.
Okay.
As a soldier on the ground, very rarely are you ever going to have...
So true.
Like, what is the real goal here? I would suspect from everything I've learned since that the goal was... test military technology for an advanced cabal military industrial complex, which is manufacturing all this very, very advanced space age war weaponry to sell to other spacefaring species. Because
people
may not understand this, We make stuff.
Yes.
As manufacturers, as builders, as assembly liners, we make precision, great equipment that other people just can't make. So we're great replicators and builders and makers of things. Well, but great replicators. I mean, we're good at taking a protocol, making an industry process, making an assembly line, training people for those protocols and making those things, having quality control to make sure that we make good products. We've been doing it for a very long time, and we're very good at making good products.
So replicators are completely not out of the question. They're
not
totally legitimate. They're completely in today's society. They're just not here on the ground floor yet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So I would say the main goal was probably just the continued development of military technology for the sale of that military technology to other folks.
And also the medical advancement, I would imagine.
Yes,
how they were able to put the bodies back in.
Absolutely. That essentially that medical technology makes every single, say this again, every single aspect of current medical technology we have completely dark ages obsolete.
Wow.
Pharmacology, invasive surgery, x-rays, MRIs, all of that is antique, dark ages technology compared to these holographic regenerating medical beds. They are...
Which are non-invasive.
No, non-invasive at all.
No pain.
No pain,
right?
Non-invasive, no drugs, no messing with your body chemistry, just telling your body, oh, keep growing, or, you know, repair this. It just tells your body to fix it using this cellular resolution holographic technology. It's pretty incredible.
How cool
pretty
is
incredible.
That? So you said there were 300 of you.
In the original project that made me, correct, Project Moonshadow, when
and
I was
were,
a child.
Moonshadow, okay. So, and were you fully cognizant of what was going on while you're during that training period?
Yes.
Or was this when you were kind of traveling in and out of... ships and time. And
no, I mean, yes, but no, I would say that I was still very cognizantly aware of it. It's just because, again, when you kind of, the next morning, you know, you wake up from this dream state where if they took you away and then brought you back, you know, that gap when you were, I'm asleep, they take me, I go do something, they bring me back, I'm asleep, and I wake up, and, oh, that part of you that's like, you remember it, you feel it, but you're really, your first inclination is to go, I didn't get picked up by your spaceship. I just had a weird dream. Oh, that was a vivid dream. Wow, I woke up and I really felt like this bullet, man. I was just...
And I had a bruise on me?
I mean, I woke up really feeling it, you know? And so you just really...
That's so true.
Again, rather than accept this more difficult, traumatic kind of explanation, you'd rather just go, oh, that was a weird dream. So, while I knew what was happening... I could remember what was happening. I remember the training, which was weird, because let me tell you, it's weird at like 11, 12, 13 to have all this really advanced military and survival training and just not understanding that for some reason you are not like your friends at school. Like, you are not doing things that they do. You are not interacting with them the same way.
13.
You know, okay, and this very funny thing happened, and it's not like, I'm not trying to brag when I say this, this is what happened. I'm in the seventh grade. And I, you know, got in a little a conflict with a fellow schoolmate over, you know, his girlfriend. And, you know, basically he was standing there kind of, you know, having this verbal confrontation. So it's like, and I basically, dude, I'm not going to fight you. This is, you know, I'm not, you know, whatever. Like, sorry that you're offended or whatever, that I like your girlfriend or whatever, but just whatever. And he basically just took a swing, just straight at me, just took a swing. And I was like, I'm not going to fight you. But what happened without me thinking about it, this autonomic, my hand just went up, bam, and I just grabbed his fist out of the air.
You were how old?
11.
Oh,
I was 11. I just went, boom, grabbed his hand out of there, and I basically just went like that, which twisted his arm around. He had to come to school next day with a sprained brace, or totally sprained his wrist.
Were you blown away by yourself?
Yeah, I grabbed, twist, and then he goes, and starts crying. I mean, we're 11.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we're big, tough
really
men
young
at this point. We're boys fighting.
Okay.
So, and I was just as surprised as anything. And of course, as soon as he starts crying and go, I mean, we're done. I let go, you know, and I'm like, okay, fight's over.
Oh, my God.
And, but
that's such a trip.
I just was like, wow, did I just grab his fist out of the air? I was like, yeah, I did. That's weird. So I didn't know what to say about that other than I'd never seen any of my other friends grab somebody's fist out of the air in a fight.
Awesome. One of my burning questions when I've been hanging out.
I mean, and I met his fist. I mean, as his fist was coming, I just met it right there. I mean, it was without thinking. Just like that. I was like, I'm not going to fight you, dude. Oh.
I have been wanting to ask you this, and I kept forgetting. Can you give me the comparison between the off-planet special ops that you're involved in versus, say, the SEALs or the Green Berets, you know, that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, first off, you're talking about the separation between really well-trained soldiers and genetically augmented soldiers.
Got it. Right.
So first of all, again, you're starting with a much... Really finely tuned raw material.
Okay, got it. And
really well-trained raw material. And essentially then the equipment. I mean, on Mars we had it was the Archer series, full-body power-assisted armor and environment suit.
Whoa.
Yeah, so this is like an exosuit.
Transformer?
Well, not exactly. Okay, so basically some people have seen these videos, Raytheon and these companies, they're like, we're just experimenting with this new exosuit technology, which is like these, you know, an exosuit has got these bars, it's a hydraulic suit soldiers can walk longer, lift heavier objects because it's a power-assisted suit. So you're not using your muscles, you're using the hydraulic muscles of a powered suit. Now, the ones that you'll see on, like, video, it's like, they don't have a power source right on it. It's a cable hooked up to a generator.
Right.
You know, and they're like, we're just now developing this technology, and maybe in a few years we'll be able to implement poppycock, right? So basically, you know, we have these very, very advanced, it's an exosuit, it's full body armor, it's an environment suit. The helmet has a HUD display, you know, so that basically...
Wow.
You're looking at
it's
all
like
these,
a computer readout.
Well, no, it's an overlay of okay. You're looking out here, and it's an overlaid across that is an infrared, a UV,
right,
a sonogram. There's all these different optics that are being overlaid in this HUD, as well as a targeting system. So basically, if I hold up my rifle, the targeter on the rifle is actually going to show a reticle upon like a video game on the inside of my helmet.
God.
So I can hip shoot like this because as I point, the reticle in my eye is actually pointing at the target, so I don't actually have to get the sight up here. Now, we had good optical sights if you want to take a nice, accurate shot, but essentially with that reticle right here, it's video game shooting. You know,
incredible.
I can just, you know, by looking at that reticle, it also identifies incoming targets. It has the ability to identify incoming projectiles, like it highlights them and lights them up and shows them coming in like a long ways off. So you can see a bullet. You can actually see a bullet coming for you 1,000 yards away. Now, to be honest, because it's lit up in the HUD, like when you see that coming, you can move because you see it way out
right there.
And even though it's flying towards you, you have a second to dodge a freaking bullet because the heads up display is actually showing you where it's coming from.
Awesome.
So it's incredible. And
so do you have less propensity for fatalities because of all of this advanced equipment versus the SEALs, et cetera, that are on ground here?
Oh, my God, yes. I mean, we had basically there's no amount of physical damage that they can't repair unless you're, like, unretrievable, you know, which is, like, fully dead.
Okay.
And essentially, though, we had what I would say is, like, a less than 5% fatality rate. I mean, so, like, of our entire division... Less than 5% of the personnel would perish, would actually die in a year.
What would you consider fully dead? Because you were talking the other day about they're doing head transplants.
Right, okay, so essentially it's about electrical activity in the brain and your silver cord. That connects to the whatever other dimensions.
So it's their time.
It's kind of even cheating that. You know, they can even really do these things that cheat. Is it your time? It's basically... Do they lose enough head, you know, skull piece, brain piece? Does the damage to the body cause a drop in electrical activity that's so fast that they can't stabilize you and, you know, get you back? And essentially, once you reach that dead electrical activity in the brain, the cord disconnects and there's no getting you back. Because basically, all they're able to do is by fixing your body, as long as that cord is connected, by preparing the body, it's going to pull that back in when the body's ready, because that's a natural process. But if the body's too damaged to repair, it wants to go. Yeah. So there's this fine line between that electrical activity being maintained or not. So, yeah, they basically can cheat death in so many different ways.
That's crazy. And I would imagine, Randy, that the medics, there's got to be a standby crew of very advanced,
yes,
not only equipment, but medics that are highly trained for this type of operation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So they're
absolutely
probably readily available.
Yes.
Now, when you were on Mars, you said, you know, 17 and a half years, and we were talking the other day about how you do agree that the solar system is basically clear, right?
Our intelligence sources would indicate that that is very true,
so,
yes.
You guys hearing that?
We've essentially, the Solar Warden Radiant Guardian fleets, which I know there's some confusion about this, so I think, let me explain this. Some people say Solar Warden, Radiant Guardian, like, is it the same thing? Is it the different thing? So in the same way that our naval fleets here on the ground in the ocean, we have a Atlantic fleet, a Pacific fleet, a North Atlantic fleet. I mean, they're divided into fleets so that one admiral isn't responsible for too many ships that are too far away.
Sure.
You don't want the
totally
Atlantic. Yeah, you don't want the Atlantic, you know, admiral trying to decide what's happening over here in the Pacific, mm-hmm, because it's just too far away. So my understanding is there's some arbitrary dividing line that splits the solar system in half, and half the one fleet on one side is the Solar Warden fleet, and the fleet on the other side is the Radiant Guardian fleet. So the Radiant Guardian Solar Warden fleets are essentially the equivalent of a Atlantic fleet, Pacific fleet.
Makes so much sense.
Yeah. You don't want one admiral in charge of too many ships too far away. And the galaxy, the solar system's big. So, you know, you're way over here and something's happened over here. You want more localized control and authority.
So now, the other thing that I thought was interesting, you and I were talking about who were kind of the badasses of the solar system. So we talked about the Procyon.
Mm-hmm.
Procyonians?
Procyonians.
Procyonians.
I think how you say that.
We talked about the Lyrans.
Yep.
And who was the third one that you were really...
The Tausiteans.
Tausiteans. And how far out are they within the solar system?
You mean their forward operating bases,
yes,
and stuff? They're, I think, mostly on moons of Jupiter and Saturn at this time.
Okay, that makes sense.
And though the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are considered, like, less desirable locations because no one wants to live on Jupiter or Saturn.
Why?
They're not habitable by our standards. That doesn't mean there is not any kind of organic life on those worlds. It just
outside
means,
or internally?
Inside, internally.
Okay.
It just means that it is such a type of environment or such a type of life that there's no way we're going to build a base on Saturn that's not going to get destroyed by the weather. Well, first of all, how are you going to build it in that weather?
Yeah, exactly.
How are you going to get down there in that weather? How are you going to land in that weather? And Jupiter's the same way. Like as a gas giant, there is this interesting theory, you know, that there's a nickel core or there is some sort of solid core, you know, in the middle that's way down beneath all these gases where the pressure is really, really built and heavy. Is it? I don't know. Well, that... Jupiter is definitely so big that the gravity and the pressure would kill us. I mean, there's just no way any human being could ever survive on Jupiter. Even if you had some kind of bubble-encapsulated city, like you'd get into that pressure and get into that gravity, and you're just dead. There's just that is a greater force in the laws of physics than we could ever be sustained by. So these moons, which have some, you know, like, what I would say is more like small life, not like a sentient form, microbial mats, microorganisms. Let's see which one is the ocean one. I always forget whether it's Io or Europa, which has the ice all over it and has the ocean underneath. Okay, so they got fish and different kind of aquatic life. But what else do they have? I don't think that they have an advanced civilization down there. And the other one, which doesn't have the ice, which has an atmosphere, but it's not conducive to you and I walking and breathing. It's just so different that if you had the time or resources to build a base there, it'd be very safe because no one really is going to want to come visit because there's really the environment is too otherwise difficult to mine or explore. So you're kind of safe there from anybody.
So you're basically the furthest out that the military has gotten is Saturn.
No. We've gotten all the way to the edge of the solar system,
okay,
for sure.
But we haven't really set up particular bases there to hang out We're more geared to the base is closer to where the earth is.
So everyone will have to forgive me because I always forget. I get Titan and Triton confused.
Okay.
One is a moon of
Titan.
Not Neptune, and the other is a moon of Neptune.
Right.
So there is a base on the moon around Neptune. Well, I forget again. Okay. I apologize whether the other one's Triton or Titan around Neptune. There's a base there. And essentially, you know, they have these large, you know, fields of these microbial mats and these microorganisms. And, you know, maybe in a few million years, they might have mice or squirrels or birds. I mean, something that's very, very primitive still. But it's going to take quite a while before anything develops there or evolves.
So the other, you know, there's been quite a few pictures, just a really quick question, where they've shown like a rooster or a squirrel
right.
or whatever crawling across
yeah,
Mars.
Yeah,
is
yeah,
that
yeah.
realistic to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. No. And interestingly enough, I know some people would expect that somehow on Mars there would all be this really weird alien life that's nothing like anything we know on Earth, when the truth is whatever connection Earth and Mars have goes back a long time. Whoever the Earthlings have been for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, and whoever the indigenous Martians have been for thousands of years, there's been a lot of back and forth. We have similar environments, similar atmospheres, similar biology.
And so, we've actually brought animals back and forth between both planets.
Let me put it this way. You know, we don't really call... Okay, so we didn't have zoology classes, you know, so mm-hmm. that's a digger. That's a bird digger. That's a tunneler. That's a little furry digger. That's a lizard digger. I mean, basically, you know, they're digging in the ground. They live in these little bushes. But, you know, they're like little Tweety birds, like we see here, little, you know, like finches and oriole. I mean, I can't really say that their patterns are like, but they're little birds. They have little lizards, these little squirrels, little rodents, some bigger lizards. I mean, it's a lot of really similar animal life. And the plant life is really similar. But I won't say it's anything exactly like here, because
right.
it's not.
Right.
But it is not so weird and alien that it's foreign. It's really like, almost like I'd call them two sides of a coin. They're really that similar.
Do you agree that you can breathe on planet Mars without wearing any
Totally.
Form? Okay, I've heard that as well.
It can be thin and difficult, but no, absolutely. It's about 700 millibars pressure, and depending on where you are, equatorial, north, south, you know, temperature-wise. But that's, yeah, totally, absolutely.
So, sorry for that. We had a little bit of a break there. So, Randy, tell me in your words, of all the kind of action
mm-hmm.
that you've seen,
mm-hmm.
what would you describe as one of your fiercest battles?
Oh, wow.
Okay. That you could share that isn't breaking, you know, your clearance.
Okay.
That would have an ultimate good ending story for all of us. Maybe a good... purpose.
Well, I mean, that's
you know, like a big victory.
Well, let me tell you right there. Stop adding conditions on that.
You're
making it less and less likely that I'm going to have a story that matches those requirements. So,
okay. How about your fiercest moment?
Yeah,
fiercest.
I mean, I can do that, but there's so many of it's war. It's not often pleasant.
Right.
Victory is so, you know,
cliche.
Well, contrived sometimes.
Yeah,
we won. 90% of everybody's dead, but we won!
Right.
I mean, that's a contrived victory, you know, like, we didn't really win if we lost everybody. So, I would have to say that it was the day that I berserked. So, the Viking warrior berserk, this is a very interesting historical concept. When I experienced it, there was no question of what was happening. I mean, there was no, like, what's happening here? I mean, it was clear... Oh, this is the berserk. Oh, holy cow. Wow.
Like, so you've heard about this before. You were aware of this.
I had heard of it, but when it happened to me, when I did it,
okay.
it was so... I mean, it's such a... You go through this amazing physiological change. Your body really goes through some kind of intense internal chemical, hormonal, energetic, and your whole body shifts your temporal frequencies. And so basically, what happened is I was, we were in a tunnel and we had sort of gotten separated, you know, in this kind of a maze of tunnels, and I was, you know, we got separated and I was like on my own, and this was not cool. I mean, you do not want to be down in a cave somewhere
yeah.
on your own.
Yeah.
Like, that's just
nobody
like,
watching your back.
Basically, you know, I was just like counting the minutes until I'm dead at that point, right? Oh, and I have to admit, I think that had something to do with how it happened. Because I gave up any notion that I was going to be able to win this fight. I was just like, I'm done. Like, these guys are going to rip me apart. I can't take these guys on by myself. Like, I'm alone. I'm done. And that's, it's not, I mean, I'm a never give up kind of guy, but there was just no way I was just realistic. I saw no way out of this situation. And so basically, you know, they kind of had me surrounded. These three reptiles had me surrounded. And I was just kind of, I was standing with my back to the wall, and I started shaking uncontrollably. Like, I mean, it wasn't fear, but it was
like an adrenaline rush almost.
But it was also what I would have to say is this sense of, if I don't do this, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, so whatever that is, when you know you're right at the edge of death, your body basically says, well, we're going to die anyway, so we might as well use every last, we might as well burn at 110% because we're going to die anyway if we don't. And so, you know, my whole body kind of started to shake uncontrollably, and I'm standing there shaking, and I'm kind of convulsing, you know, and my vision's starting to get blurry, so it was pretty intense. And I can only describe, you know, their response to what was happening as shock, surprise, and humor. They kind of saw what was happening, and they kind of stopped. Instead of just taking me out at that point, they stopped and were watching me kind of shake.
Oh, my God.
And what I can only describe is them looking at each other and laughing. Oh, look at this. Oh, he's terrified. He's freaking, he's shaking in his boots, you know. And then, basically, the weirdest thing ever happened. You know, I felt like this shaking again, going up, 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 right up to the top of my head, and I thought my head was going to pop. And then straight back down to the bottom of my feet like lightning.
Whoa.
And then I popped. I threw up in my suit. I barfed in my suit. And to be honest, it was like embarrassing. I was like, oh my God, I just threw up in my suit.
And you're just blown away.
You know, I was like, oh my God. You know, I just went, and I barfed. And I was like, oh my God. But then something happened at that point. And I basically, like, my eyes got real wide. I felt my body get heavier. Like, I mean, all of a sudden I felt like I weighed like an extra 1,000 pounds. I felt like I was made out of stone.
Whoa.
And they went from, you know, kind of standing there laughing, and all of a sudden they were frozen. It's like they weren't moving. And I stood there for a second and then watched their eyes looking back at each other in like slow motion, like they were doing this. And I was like, what in the world is happening?
You slowed time down.
You change your temporal coefficient, so you actually speed up. So it appears as if they are going slower, but I'm actually moving way faster. And so essentially at that point, you know, I grabbed my personal utility tool, which is this hand-to-hand, vicious hand-to-hand weapon. I'm not even going to try and describe it because it's just mean-spirited, really. It's just a mean-spirited tool. And I pulled it out. And I lunged at the first guy, and again, force equals mass times velocity squared, okay? I don't know what speed I'm moving at, but temporally I'm moving much, much, much faster. So one lunge at this guy with my personal utility tool, and his head came right off his shoulders. And then his buddy looks at me, his eyes pop open surprised, and without even skipping a beat, my hand came the other way and took his head off. And then the third guy, basically, as a couple steps back, he starts to turn. Like, I mean, he's like, I'm going to run away, but he's moving so slow. He just did another leap forward, lunged, and then took his head off. And then I stopped, and my whole body started to, like, shake again. You know, oh, God. And then I hit the ground, you know, and I barfed again. I threw up again.
Sure.
And at this point, my head is throbbing, like someone has just clamped a vice around my head, like, and I have this massive headache. I'm sick to my stomach. My whole body is still like, you know, like, oh my God, what just happened? But I stand up and I'm looking at three dead headless bodies.
And you're going, how did that happen?
And I went, how in the world did that happen? And basically, without thinking too much further, I just turned around like the way I came and just ran until I ran into my unit. And, you know, they were like, oh, this way, we got the way out, you know, and we bailed out, and basically I made it outside, and I dropped, I passed out.
I can't even talk about that. Yeah, no problem. Okay, so let's move on to, like, you said that after Mars, you had a very interesting, kind of not so exciting, exhilarating time just kind of patrolling the solar system. Can you describe for us what an SOP day was? You know, how did you get up? What did it look like? What did the shifts look like? What does it feel like to be cruising through the solar system?
Well, so comparatively to, you know, what we might say the excitement of life on the ground, which is a lot of adrenaline, a lot of physical fighting, a lot of sweating, a lot of bleeding. I mean, it's really very raw and physical and, you know, down to Earth, except down to Mars, right, I guess. But you're very, you know, on the ground with it. It's a really different experience. So in some ways, being a pilot on the Nautilus was almost like a vacation. It was like, sweet, I got the skate job now. You know, because basically, you know, you're in a controlled environment now. No elements, no heat, no cold, nobody trying to stab you, you know, or set you on fire. Right. Just this nice, quiet ship to do your job on. And, you know, your fellow pilots and your air wing commanders, it's all very pleasant. And so, you know, you get up to a pleasant alarm, and there's no, you're an officer, you're officers. No one's shouting at you anymore. No one's like, get up, let's go! Like, you only do that when you're enlisted people. When you're an officer, they can be like, okay, time to go. I mean, it's a nice, polite knock. Let's go, everybody. You know, time to get to work. Totally different deal, right? And so basically, you know, you get up, you shower, you have breakfast, put on your uniform, and then you muster down at the hangar bay, and you meet with your air wing commander, and he's got your daily orders of where sector you're patrolling. You get in your fighters, you launch out, and basically you do a square with a crisscross pattern. So you kind of go here, 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 and then cross, cross, cross.
Interesting.
So that's the cover pattern when you're doing a sector. And so basically, as kind of, like I say, sort of adrenaline exciting that life on Mars was, in some ways the tedium, even though I loved this tedium, the tedium of being a pilot on the Nautilus was, hey, what are we doing today? Patrol. What are we doing tomorrow? Patrol. What are we doing later? Patrol. What are we doing next week? Patrol, 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 patrol. Like, that's all you do. You get up, you patrol, you come back, you eat lunch, you patrol, you come back, you have dinner, you get your daily debrief, we play cards, you know, and then you go to bed. This nice, quiet barracks, and, you know, someone politely knocks in and says, all right, let's get up and do it again, and then you patrol. I mean, it's just, it's kind of the same boring deal, and essentially because any traffic that's coming in the same way that we guide air traffic is like, okay, follow this flight path, do not deviate, you know, if someone's coming in. So as we're patrolling the sectors where no one should be. We're not patrolling flight paths. That's very well regulated and marked.
That makes sense.
Yeah, we're patrolling the areas where no one should be.
Right.
And so basically, if you run into someone who shouldn't be there, one of two things is going to happen immediately. They're going to run or they're going to fight. And I would say 9 times out of 10, they run. They just run. And so essentially, at that point, we are the most technologically advanced junkyard dogs in the in the solar system.
What do we refer to it as?
The Earth Defense Force. No, it's the Earth Defense Force. It's a global organization.
Okay, so question. How many other defense forces are there of the other planets?
Could not tell you. I mean, we have the Mars Defense Force. There's the Earth Defense Force, which is sort of, you know, solar system-wide program. I couldn't answer that specifically because I haven't been everywhere else. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine if there were anywhere else that we got that.
So you run into quite a few, though.
I would imagine.
Different types of species, planets, and ships. Ships, actually.
Yeah, I mean, and basically, again, you know, they either run off or we, you know, have a little fight and then...
You got to tell them that story. Tell them the story about how when you get hit by an EMP. Oh. This is a hilarious story, you got to
tell. Okay, so you know, we're flying along, we're chasing after this guy, and as his escape plan, he fires off, he basically drops out a probe as he takes off, like a little space mine, and as we get close, it pops out this EMP, and so you're, you know, shh, and then, oh, crap, and you start spinning, you know, like, like free floating, it's just, oh, crap, and all the lights go out, your power's off, and your life support is a mechanical oxygen system, so it's not like you're going to freeze to death. The insulation is really good. There's also, if you need an emergency blanket or something, it's not a big deal. Someone's going to come get you pretty soon. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not, we still call it dead in the water, even mm-hmm. though you're in space. You go, oh, I'm dead in the water. But as soon as you radio back in, someone's going to come get you. They'll tow you back in. It's no big deal. Or if you're not that far away, the whole Nautilus will just come in and pick everybody up and tow them in one at a time.
Yeah, that's right.
And then they have to go through and repair the electrical systems and recondition the electrical systems after an EMP burst. But basically, here's the funny part, right? You got to call back. You got to call back to the Nautilus. Well, that your electrical systems are dead. Your batteries are dead. Your generator's dead. You got no juice. So underneath the cockpit, there's a panel. It pops off. And then you get down there and you start cranking the hand crank at the hand generator. You're like charging up. And there's a red light, a yellow light, and a green light. And so as you're cranking it up, the red light, you have to be bright enough that it's charging, you're getting enough amperage. And then as it's getting charged, the little yellow light comes on. You're like, almost ready. And then the green light comes on. You're like, okay, we got enough charge to make a phone call. And then you pull out this handle. It's like these old World War II phones, you know, like these big, thick...
Well, this is with billion-dollar technology.
Oh, yeah. You know? And so you pull out this old crank phone, you know... And then you crank the antenna, you know, there's a deploy antenna, you crank out the deploy the antenna, and you pick up the phone, you crank it up, and you go, okay, we're dead in the water, come get us. And then, you know, they come get
God,
you.
It I'm is just, so glad you said
it
that.
Is so ironic, you know, because you're like, don't we have some more technologically advanced thing to do? And it's like, what? All the batteries are dead. What are you going to do? It's like the only thing you got is a hand crank.
God, that's so funny.
But it is a funny feeling. You're like, I'm in the most advanced freaking spaceship. I've got to hand crank this thing so I can make a call. Where's my quarter? Come on, give me a payphone. It's hilarious. All you can do in that situation is laugh at yourself.
Right, right.
You're like, I could save me now back home. You know,
it's just... too funny. So here's just an excellent question for just about anybody that's listening, and that is, if you were asked, do you feel that we literally are in a place where this is a rescue mission for planet Earth, how would you answer that?
I would answer a little bit vaguely and say most probably yes.
That's very safe.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind that, you know, my public conversations to a certain point, it is my job to speak truthfully.
Absolutely.
It is my job to speak honestly. But understanding what the tactics are mean that it is really not appropriate protocol for me to speak too closely to anything we believe may be part of a defensive or tactical protocol in which if I talk too openly, it just tells too much about what we know or about what our plans or strategies might be.
Yes.
So my vague, safe answer is, well, yeah, I'd say that's probably true, and anything I may know more about that would not be appropriate protocol to discuss openly.
Okay. So... now, with this special operations off-planet, mm-hmm. what's the average time that people serve?
It is a 20-year tour of duty, period. Minimum, that's it. You do 20 years.
So there what's are some senior going office- on with you?
There are some senior officers who I know are in for longer. You know, like, okay. I know the captain of the ship, you know, when I remember saying, well, you know, when I finish my 20 years, and he's like, yeah, lucky you. You know, and I was like, what do you mean, when do you get out? And he was like, dead. I mean,
when I'm dead.
He was kind of like he was like in his 50s and he was like, you know, I'm not going to be out of here for another 20 years. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, you got a 20 year tour. I got a 40 year tour. Mm. I was like, wow.
I was thinking that would apply if they can do the kinds of things they can do with
yeah.
the body.
Yeah.
So you've been in over 20 years,
yeah,
right?
Correct.
And are you intending to be a lifer? Is this like something you really want to?
That's actually not an option.
It's not an option.
The commission contract, when you become a commissioned officer, there's another contract. Mm. And you take another oath because there's just some slight difference in your legal obligations and the oaths that you make and take as an enlisted person or as an officer. So what we call in the United States Marine Corps Special Section commissioned life officers, it's written out that way, means that technically, even if I'm retired, I haven't done anything for years, I'm 98 years old, you know, my walker.
With a walker. I seriously doubt you'll be there.
Well, the point
you'll
is...
You'll just go up and get another couple of new legs.
Well, this is what I'm saying. I could be 99, like, I'm an old man, you know, and I could be that, and they could be, oh, we need you for something. Hey, guess what? We got another 30-year-old body for you. How about it? And, like, who wouldn't trade that, you know?
That's so awesome.
But the truth is, I'm legally obligated. It's contractual. Sure. So, to be honest, they can, as long as I'm alive, they can call and say, we want you to do this or do that. They could reactivate my full commission, and I would be legally and contractually and oath obligated to show up.
It's like being in the reserves almost, kind of.
It is. Yeah. It is. You are in the reserves until the day you die.
Yeah.
Because they don't know what they're going to need or who they're going to need for what. So they want to take no chances that they won't have enough personnel to deal with something. They want to make sure that if they can reacquire maximum personnel for any emergency situation, that they can. So
that totally segues into my next question, which is all about, I love to hear your take on what is really going on with the harvesting of souls on the planet. That you can talk about.
I hate to say it, but I'm sorry, I don't think there's anything I can comment publicly about that at this time. Other than that, we know it's a thing that happens. We are concerned of the illegality of it, and there are investigations and so forth to work the problem, but it's a complicated problem, and what, you know, really that becomes an inappropriate protocol to discuss an open investigation.
I'm totally honoring that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just shut me up if it's crossing that line.
And I've had to kind of start playing this balance. The more information I get, the more of a balancing act I'm having to play, because I'm having to, I kind of wouldn't mind talking about that, but is it safe? Not for me safe,
but is it safe
for personnel who are doing that job and doing that work? Is it safe for them for me to talk about that? And if I feel like I'm in any
way... Especially those that are trying to extract the souls out of the abducted areas, whatever.
Yeah, if I'm in any way endangering other personnel, you know, other Marine, I have to say, no, I'm sorry, I can't talk about that, so...
Okay.
Sorry, can't talk about that.
Sorry. So, now the other thing that I really wanted to know about is the involvement between the on-ground military.
Right.
And the involvement with the off-planet military special section.
Right.
Is there an absolute no man's land between those, or are you overlapping in your missions and assignments and that sort of thing? Are you working cohesively together, or do you feel that it's really totally its own entity?
I think that Richard Dolan's use of the term breakaway civilization is completely appropriate to use here. That there is a widening gap.
Joseph wants to see you in the kitchen.
There is a Mac. Okay, I'm sorry, that just blew my train of thought, whatever I was saying. I'm sorry.
No, that's no problem. So, is there an actual overlay between those?
Okay, thank you. Okay, right. Now I'm back to you. So, no, I would say that there is an ever-widening gap to try and put those forces farther and farther and farther away so that this one becomes the breakaway civilization and this one is... And I think that separation is to try and encourage the personnel in this outfit to disassociate themselves from the personnel in this outfit to, you know, this whole, we're better than them, they're a bunch of douchebags. I mean, essentially to try and create this separation so that they no longer see themselves as brothers in arms, and instead some sort of competitive force.
Because they're doing completely different tactics.
Very. You know? And using completely different technology, completely different information.
And aren't they depending on, you know, forgive me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me they're depending a great deal more on their physical strength of their body. They're not depending as much, at least from the SEALs that I've spoken to, for example. Mm-hmm. The technology that's available to them is certainly nowhere even close to what you have.
And I've had real conversations with, you know, current Marine Corps commanding officers who are dealing with that kind of level of, what do we call it, sort of a low level of technology. And
I think
were some very honest and sincere conversations, and where these other officers were not hiding anything at all. They were trying to have a very sincere conversation with me. And they're... limited knowledge, or what I would say absence of knowledge about most of this stuff, was just so genuine. I don't know about that. I've never heard of that. I mean, So they really are just kept in the dark and not encouraged to look in those areas. Hmm. So
interesting. And so where do you see us going now as far as we've kind of cleaned out the solar system? We're getting a little bit more buttoned down on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. And you and I were talking the other day. You potentially agreed you don't want to be held to it. But maybe between 10% of the bad boys still,
yeah,
here.
Yeah, I would call that I would call that a really difficult number to be precise about. So we have a current estimate that we say, yeah, maybe about 10% of the problematic ET groups that we had even just 10 or 15 years ago are really all that's left. The fleets have done a fabulous job of pushing invaders and undesirables out of the solar system. The on-the-ground teams have done a great job of extracting a lot of these personnel. In some cases, it's just these really expert teams who have these amazing scanners, and they can walk down the street and walk up to the thing. I'm sorry, your papers aren't in order. We're going to have to escort you off world. And,
and this is happening more and more.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. More and more. More and more and more. And so it's
all
just
speakers. They're serving in the kitchen for speakers.
So, yeah. I mean, that's just the way it happens. So, yeah.
So, do you also feel that we're getting to a place where the number of alien intruders, and I hate to use that word alien, but do you feel like it's gotten down to a very specific species?
No. No, I think, in fact, what we're learning is that we have sort of a new category of species that we're dealing with, which we're calling the jackal species. This is more than one group that it's really kind of, these are species who have evolved from sort of scavenger species, so that they have no desire for global domination. That's a waste of time and energy and money for them.
Oh, good.
However, they'd love to send an expedition and, in a moment of weakness, like a jackal, is why we call them the jackals, run in, grab an arm, grab a leg, rip a chunk off, and go. Essentially, if in a moment of weakness they can come in, grab water, materials, minerals, slaves, protein, whatever it is that they want.
Wow.
If essentially,
wow.
And like pirates, if they essentially can make that pay for the trip, then it's worth it to them. If they get enough stuff to say, hey, we paid for the trip, then that counts. And so we're not worried about them taking over the world. We're worried about, a level of weakness in the fabric of our society, allowing them to come in and just essentially do a lot of damage that we're going to just have to do a ton of damage control to fix. It's just going to suck. So,
And do you feel that, is it possible, probably, likely, that some of these species are, in fact, actually abducting aliens, taking them to their own home planet, and using them as a slave?
Oh, yeah, that absolutely happens. I mean, the food chain, as we kind of call it, is, you're wherever you are in the middle of that ladder. I mean, there's the whatever's above you and whatever's below you, and it's, again, not uncommon from an evolutionary standpoint for certain species to just take advantage of, holding hostage or enslaving other species to do their work for them, because essentially, who wants to work for themselves?
Are the Earthlings basically kind of like a targeted species because of our history?
We're just vulnerable. No. We're just vulnerable because we still are psionically emergent, and we're not really sure, how to understand good, bad from these beings that we can't really read their intention. So we're vulnerable. We're really gullible. So gullible.
Very nice.
And this sort of, dangle the shiny thing, and we'll go running after it, and essentially, we're just very gullible, and so it's easy for people to just allow themselves to be used or manipulated, or even kidnapped, and even agree to be kidnapped. If someone comes down in their big ship and says, come on, everybody, it's an evacuation plan, we're going to take you to safety. And then you get on, and it's a cattle car, and you realize you're going to the slave mines, and it's
right.
But once you're on that ship and you're out of the solar system, you're out of our jurisdiction. Sorry, we can't come get you.
Which is even more of a reason why we need your sort of force team up there. And do you also feel that there's been some success in the human species on the ground floor starting to understand this new, they're referring to it as the event, okay? Mm-hmm. They're also referring to it as a possible, alien landing. It's a big mass production, that kind of thing. There's so many different variables that are out there. Do you feel that most human beings are more receptive these days to that possibility of mass landings?
The polling data suggests that.
Because I would imagine the military would be very on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, the polling data suggests that people are more accepting of the notion of extraterrestrials, that the government's keeping secrets and that they could show up any minute. Yeah, no, I think that we have a curve of polling data to show that those numbers keep going up and up and up.
And you being off-world, checking the space environment, if something like that were to happen where, let's say it was an alien species that was not beneficial, would you be involved on a terrestrial level? Or is there still that demarcation where you stay there in that jurisdiction and there's military troops on the ground that are going to handle a terrestrial situation?
That's a specific question about jurisdictional jurisprudence and investigation powers that would be inappropriate protocol for me to discuss. So again, that's just too specific of a question about something that's, again, could provide intelligence that could bring harm we're doing. So yeah, I just can't answer that.
Just, like I said, I can't help it.
Sure.
So at this point in time, I mean, I know we're coming to the end of this this interview, and we're certainly going to open it up
I'm
to a lot of the people.
I'm ready for lunch.
Yeah, we're going to open this up to a lot of people. Please go ahead and send your questions in, and Randy and I can do another interview, maybe a
Q&A
or something.
Absolutely, no, be happy to.
Really funnel in on some of the really specific areas that we're all curious about. But is there anything you can close this with as far as, what do you feel it's looking like in the next, say, 3 to 6 months? And I know you're not predicting, do you feel like there's anything that we have to look forward to?
Oh, yeah, of course. I think that there's no question that we are in a war with us ourselves as Earthlings against other Earthlings. Do we want to consider the cabal still Earthlings, or are they just living on Mars? I mean, but again, humans against humans, we're still having a conflict amongst ourselves. We're also still warring with potential ETs that we're not on good terms with. So here's, as a Marine, what I have to say about any militarized conflict. It's over when it's over, and not 1 minute before. So, and the other simple part of that is I know a lot of people say, oh, well, the bad guys are in control. Well, the good guys are going to win. And it's like, let me simplify this. If it was true that the forces of evil, forces of darkness, were strong enough right now to win, it'd be over. If the forces of light and goodness were strong enough to win right now, it'd be over. So if either one of them was in a position for immediate victory, we would not be having this conversation. We would not be in this conflict. It would be decided. So the fact that we were still in a conflict, the fact that we were still engaging and fighting, means it's not resolved.
Correct.
It's just not resolved. It's a chessboard with many things happening. Pieces are removing, and when it's done, and the king's knocked over, it's done. But not until then. So, who knows what's going to happen? We're on this curve of, again, what I sort of call the inevitability of this is going to happen next week, next month, 2 years. Why are we still bickering over time frames and everyone's running right now? But you know what? People, get used to the fact, the understanding that we don't know when this is going to happen, but it's going to happen. And I'm sorry that people don't want to hear that
it's
answer.
It's inevitable.
Everybody's impatient. Everybody wants it to happen now. But you know what?
It's been a long road.
Practice your patience, people, and just realize that we're getting there. And everything that I see here and with my command, we're getting there. But we're going to get there when we get there. Like, you get on the car and you're with your parents and you take a trip and you're, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Well, stop asking when we're there yet, because we're going to get there when we get there. Or someone might say, I'm going to turn this car right around if you won't stop. Okay, we're going to get there when we get there.
So everybody, please support Randy Kramer. He's at earthcitizenconsulting.org. And again, I hope that just with some of the questions that I've asked, you can see that even though as a military officer and soldier, he's seen battle, a lot of us don't want to hear about it or talk about it, you can also see that he is completely, totally a human being who's in his heart, who really wants to serve and assist. And I can honestly say it's been an honor meeting you. From one military brat to another military officer.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to our next ability to have a pleasant conversation. Absolutely. My pleasure.
Okay. Take care. Everybody check out galacticconnection.com. We'll see you on the other side next Tuesday, 3 to 4:55 p.m. Pacific. Lots of love. Here to serve. Love.